The headlines: Iran's leader takes Arab governments to task for shaking hands. A friendship with the Zionist enemy under pressure from the U.S. government. A report says the Pentagon has failed to track civilian deaths in Yemen, even though they were caused by an array of deadly U.S.-made weapons. Also ahead in this newscast, an intense battle going on for the city of Severodonetsk. Ukraine's military says it may pull back, but will keep fighting. Our top story for this half hour: the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution hits out at the nexus between some Arab governments and the Israeli regime, saying the normalization deals would not benefit them at all. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei says the ties with Israel would harm those Arab countries, as the regime's main motive is to exploit them. He underlined that Arab nations are also opposed to their governments inking the deals and shaking hands with the Israeli regime. Ayatollah Khamenei further said that such agreements were the outcome of constant U.S. pressure on those governments. Four Arab countries, the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Sudan, and Morocco, normalized their relations with Israel under U.S. brokered agreements in 2020. The move sparked an outcry in the Muslim world. Palestinians in particular denounced the normalization as a stab in their back. Iran is asking the Board of Governors of the International Atomic Energy Agency to vote down an anti-Tehran resolution submitted by the U.S. and its three European allies, Britain, Germany, and France. The draft resolution will be put to vote at this week's meeting of the 35-member policy-making body of the IAEA. The draft reportedly calls on Iran to fully cooperate with the agency to clarify and resolve outstanding safeguard issues. It also accuses Iran of having undeclared nuclear materials at some of its sites. As the Board of Governors convened Monday, IAEA Chief Rafael Grossi also said in a press briefing that Iran's cooperation with the agency has been insufficient and inadequate. Iranian officials immediately rejected the claims, saying the country has fully cooperated with the UN nuclear watchdog.
Sampling at a couple of sites showed a very little amount of nuclear particles. Subsequently, Iran offered the required and sufficient explanations to the IAEA. Constant pressures by the U.S., some Western countries, and the Israeli regime are among the reasons why the IAEA has put the issue as a major point on its agenda. The agency has no independent role.
The head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran echoed Gharib Abadi's remarks. Mohammad Islami said Iran has provided the IAEA with adequate explanations, but the agency does not have a serious will to call Tehran's response as convincing. He criticized the IAEA for relying on Israeli reports. Meantime, the European Union issued a statement at the IAEA Board of Governors. The statement voiced support for the full implementation of the 2015 Iran deal, known as the JCPOA. It said the removal of anti-Iran sanctions is an essential part of the deal. The statement, however, voiced concern over what it called a series of Iranian actions inconsistent with the JCPOA. Earlier, academic and geopolitical policy advisor Alexander Ozadegan joined us to give his perspective on an anti-Iran resolution the U.S. and its allies are pushing at the board meeting of the IAEA.
Any little thing in Iran is going to be politicized. Whether it was the train that got derailed from Mashhad to Yazd, or the 10-story building collapsing, the enemies of Iran are going to politicize it. They're going to link it to the nuclear issue, and it's going to just go on from there and never stop. The bottom line is that sanctions are terror tools used by all imperialistic powers to destroy, sabotage, and implode the stability in other countries. It's economic terrorism is what we call it. The idea is to destroy the spirit of the people. Economic coercion. Iran's case going up the chain at the IAEA level, and the accusations are serious. Of course, Iranian military facilities are not obliged to be inspected, but that's exactly the point that they're trying to make. IAEA and also the politicization by United States and E3.
Staying with Iran, at least 17 are reported dead and dozens more wounded in a train derailment in a central city just hours ago. Reports say over a dozen of those wounded are in critical condition. The incident has happened near the desert city of Tabas in South Khorasan province on the rail, linking it to the central city of Yazd. Rescue teams with ambulances and helicopters have been dispatched to the area. According to the initial reports, the train carrying nearly 350 passengers collided with an excavator. Further investigation is underway to find out the exact cause of the accident. New reports are indicating that the humanitarian crisis in the war-torn Yemen is worsening. According to a report by the UN Children's Agency, UNICEF, the number of people in need of humanitarian assistance has risen to more than 23 million over the past year. The report also says the number of Yemenis requiring food assistance has jumped to over 17 million. It has cited the ongoing war, continuing economic shocks, and decreasing aid as the reasons. Another report by the International Monetary Fund says that rising food prices and inflation worldwide amid the Ukraine war have deteriorated the crisis in Yemen. Saudi Arabia, along with some of its allies, launched a war on Yemen in 2015. It has directly or indirectly claimed the lives of hundreds of thousands of Yemenis. The UN has already described Yemen as the world's worst humanitarian disaster. Well, for 7 years, the Saudi-led coalition has been using U.S.-made weapons to kill Yemenis, but American officials have failed to keep track of how many civilians have fallen victim to their deadly munitions. An internal U.S. government report blames that on the State Department and the Pentagon. The report also says they have failed to assess the use of American-made weapons in the killings. The report has not been publicly released yet. And the State Department is apparently trying to classify some parts and redact a number of lines. The findings span three U.S. administrations since 2015 when the war started. The report is especially important considering that President Joe Biden is preparing to visit Saudi Arabia this summer. He's facing criticism for failing to deliver on earlier promises to pressure the kingdom over its rights records and to cut the sales of offensive weapons used in the Yemen war.
When Saudi Arabia launched an air campaign on Yemen in March 2015, it assured the U.S. administration of President Barack Obama that it would oust the Ansarullah movement within months. But the war, aimed at restoring a former friendly government in the Yemeni capital Sana'a, dragged on with limited military gains. Under Obama, whose government had close bonds with Saudi Arabia, indiscriminate and disproportionate airstrikes continued on Yemen. Homes, markets, schools, hospitals, weddings, and funerals were targeted with U.S.-made weapons, including widely banned cluster munitions. An all-out Saudi blockade exacerbated Yemen's health and nutrition crises, and diseases like cholera began to spread like wildfire. And all those happened amid military and diplomatic support provided by the Obama administration. The U.S. also stood silent in 2016 when Saudi Arabia, through threats of cutting funds to the UN, finally forced the world body to drop it from its list of the worst offenders against children for its attacks on Yemeni kids. Obama lost all chances to stop the slaughter. Donald Trump followed in the footsteps of his predecessor in supporting Saudi Arabia and made his first trip as U.S. president to the Arab Kingdom. Hours after landing in the Saudi capital Riyadh on the 20th of May 2017, Trump sealed a $350 billion arms deal with King Salman, the largest in world history. The transaction included tanks, combat ships, missile defense systems, as well as radar, communications, and cybersecurity technology. 2 years later, the U.S. president vetoed a bipartisan resolution to force stop America's involvement in Yemen's bloodshed. Like Obama, Trump, too, missed all the chances to end the slaughter.
This war has to end.
That's what incumbent Joe Biden said last year, just weeks into his presidency, announcing an end to U.S. assistance for Saudi Arabia's offensive operations in Yemen as well as relevant arms sales. However, months later, that promise was broken as his government approved two arms deals worth over $1 billion. To support the United Arab Emirates against Yemen's retaliatory attacks, the U.S. is now deploying a destroyer and fighter jets in the UAE, a key member of the Saudi-led military coalition. France also says it will give military support to the UAE to help it protect its airspace. The Biden administration is also planning to bring Yemen's Ansarullah movement back on a U.S. blacklist. Aid organizations warn that the move would prevent the delivery of critical humanitarian assistance to millions of innocent people and could have adverse humanitarian consequences.
It will have much effect on Yemeni civilians because many UN agency and NGOs are working in Yemen. If they the United States will continue or if they will declare the Houthi as a terrorist group, this will have a huge and a bad effect on Yemeni civilians.
By sticking to warmongering policies, the current U.S. president is also missing on his chances to stop the war, a conflict that the UN says has already turned Yemen into the largest humanitarian crisis in the world.
Russian and Ukrainian forces remain engaged in fierce fighting in Severodonetsk, a key city in eastern Luhansk province. Now the provincial governor says that Ukrainian troops may have to retreat to stronger positions in the city. Sergei Gaidai says Russia is expected to step up its attacks on Severodonetsk, which has been turned into a key battleground. However, he stressed that the Ukrainian military will not give up. On Tuesday, the Russian defense minister claimed his troops have been in full control of residential areas in Severodonetsk. Sergei Shoigu's remarks came after Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said that his forces are outnumbered by more powerful Russian forces, but they still have a chance to fight back. Zelensky also said that Ukraine will continue the fight until it takes back all its territory and that stalemate is not an option. White supremacists are no longer causing trouble exclusively inside the United States. American authorities are now concerned about the battle-hardened extremists fighting in Ukraine who are set to return to their homeland. That's particularly worrying amid the rising violent incidents inside the U.S.
U.S. authorities are questioning Americans flying to and coming back from Ukraine. Documents reviewed by Politico show that the U.S. government is gathering information about Americans who are planning to leave the U.S. for Ukraine and are tracking their activities after they return. That only backs up reports that American ultranationalists and white supremacists are moving to Ukraine to join the fight against Russia alongside those Russia brands as, quote, neo-Nazis.
This is the model that we've seen play out time and time again, going back to Libya and Afghanistan and Iraq and certainly Syria and other places. And of course, we'll see it play out again, because ultimately, in my opinion, what's happening in the Ukraine was made to happen inevitably by U.S. policy. And it's, in effect, another example of a proxy war. In this instance, between the U.S. and Russia.
But it appears that the political optics of the matter is of a secondary concern to U.S. authorities, who see the country's national security at a greater risk. Documents obtained from the U.S. Customs and Border Protection mention six unnamed Ukraine-bound Americans questioned at the airport who were either war veterans or had had military training. Two of the six were carrying military equipment. At least three had links to far-right groups. Amid the recent rise in gun violence and mass shootings in the U.S., the country would see deadlier attacks if the perpetrators have the experience of being in an actual war zone.
Well, the UN has issued a stark warning of multiple looming food crises in war-torn countries. In a new report, the world body also said Afghanistan is the new entry to the list of countries at highest alert facing catastrophic conditions. Rahmatullah Bawan reports from Kabul.
In a new report aimed at highlighting hunger hotspots, the UN bodies warned that Afghanistan is the new entry to the list of countries at highest alert, facing catastrophic conditions. The report says, beside other causes, the ripple effects of the war in Ukraine, including rising prices, are adding to the difficulties of people to provide food.
Today, food prices are skyrocketing globally due to war in Ukraine and wheat and food exports crisis. Afghanistan, as an importing and dependent country, has received major impacts. Since we don't receive imported food or goods, we witness a quick rise in prices and food scarcity. Now the prices of food items are doubled and few people can afford them.
At the same time, Afghan middle-class families are sliding into poverty and hunger, as unemployment has been on the rise. Some also say that they are struggling to make ends meet.
Unemployment and poverty have severely increased. Not only me, but all of the people have slided into poverty. Joblessness has harmed us all. Last year I was a construction worker, but today I can't provide some loaves of bread for my family as I am unemployed. We are unable to make ends meet. The prices of food items have already soared.
Advocates in the country express concern about Afghanistan's worsening situation, saying the West, especially the U.S., share a major role in world poor people's suffering.
If we provide the percentage, the U.S. is 60-70% to blame for the ongoing crisis in Afghanistan, mainly due to their moves and mistakes. In addition, now the Ukraine war is affecting the Afghan economy, so who is prolonging the war in Ukraine? Prolonging the war might harm superpowers, but it definitely ruins the economy and lives of vulnerable people across the globe.
The UN Refugee Agency has also called for $3 billion in urgent aid to Afghanistan before winter to avert famine and death. Afghanistan is facing multiple humanitarian crises. Poverty and hunger, in particular, are taking their toll on millions of people in the country. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Well, that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bazaar.
Hey. Health is a crucial social and economic asset. It is seen as a cornerstone for human development and the expansion of any economy. It is also considered a fundamental human right. The medical device industry is a sector with the sole purpose of improving the quality of life of its customers. Moreover, it's a source of medical innovation with heavy regulations. As a result, a lot happens behind the scenes before medical devices are released into the market.
Well, hello there, and welcome to another edition of Bazaar. This time, we will venture through Iran's medical sector while shining the spotlight on medical device production. We wanted to understand how this sector has grown over the years and uncover who the major players are in this field. Plus, we will look at this sector's contribution to society and the economy. So, let's get to it.
The capital city, Tehran, has been buzzing with multiple industry exhibits in recent weeks. One of the most anticipated exhibits is the Medical Laboratory Device Show, which drew a lot of participants this year. We visited the expo to see how this market is faring and check out some of the latest developments. We caught up with several companies holding pavilions at the exhibit. Virajin was one of them. It specializes in making machines and equipment used in labs for research and diagnosis. Many holding companies were also present at the show, along with their subsidiaries, who presented their products. But that's not all. The exhibit also provides a platform for getting to know what types of services these holding companies offer.
I should say that we are a holding company, including four different companies. The holding company name is Vista Padina, and the subsidiaries companies are Tubanegin, which is active in fields of molecular biology and life sciences for more than 25 years, and Arya Tashkis Pars, which is active in fields of the tubes for the blood collection from very well-known companies for more than 20 years, and they are one of the main suppliers of the tubes for the laboratories to collect the bloods for the tests. One of our companies is just for engineering and giving backups, after-sales service and backup for the instruments. And the other company is Sima Polymer, which they have the production line for the plastic wares of the for the laboratories in different applications.
Thousands and thousands of products were on display here, which are mainly used in medical laboratories. Some companies displayed consumable items used in labs like swabs or thinning liquids. Others produced diagnostic kits. It might be interesting to know that medical diagnostic kits used to be previously imported. However, now with the efforts of research-based firms, many of these items have been indigenized. We spoke with a company that not only has saved the country millions on imports, but also supports various knowledge-based startups.
Exhibits like this one are bustling with people. It's a place where downstream and upstream companies in the medical lab sector can gather and showcase their latest. It also is an excellent place for potential investors to scout out lucrative investment opportunities and check out the local competition. So scores of companies participated in this exhibit this year.
Among these companies were knowledge-based manufacturers, startups, raw material suppliers, and much more. Visitors are given a chance to evaluate and discover the latest innovative products and solutions in the lab sector across all ranges. The exhibit has been put on hold since 2019 due to the coronavirus outbreak. Now it is in full swing again. Medical Laboratory Device Exhibit took place in Iran Mall.
It is one of the biggest shopping centers in Iran that also offers an expansive space for trade shows. The coronavirus outbreak is subsiding nationwide due to the extensive vaccination campaign. And now, many businesses are enjoying in-person interactions through this exhibition once again. The goal of the Medical Lab Device Show is to further develop services and products used in clinical labs. It's a place where domestic and foreign participants can interact and strengthen networks. It also gathers medical industry participants, such as doctors and hospital owners, among many others in the healthcare trade. In addition, the Expo is a platform where industry decision makers visit and where scores of business deals are closed. The exhibition was coupled with a medical lab science and device conference. It was the 13th round of the international conference that was jointly held by the Medical Council and the Association of Clinical Laboratory Doctors. This was a significant event in the field of lab sciences aiming to improve lab services and technology. Some 2,700 participants from various fields of lab sciences joined the event, either virtually or in person. The five-day conference included 25 specialized seminar panel meetings with international guest speakers among Iranian experts in the field. The purpose of the conference is to exchange scientific knowledge and bridge a dialogue between lab sciences and clinical disciplines. It was also a platform to check out the latest global tech that are being used to improve lab services. Many hot topics were discussed during the conference, such as lessons learned from the coronavirus outbreak. Other discussions revolved around the future of medical diagnostic labs and the technology that will shape them. Industry practitioners say medical lab sciences is one of the most overlooked sectors in the industry, yet it plays a crucial role in the medical sector. Some 70% of all diseases in society are diagnosed by the laboratory community. All disciplines of laboratory sciences, inducing lab specialists, pathologists, and clinicians, were at the forefront of the battle with the coronavirus. These specialists worked tirelessly around the clock to create diagnostic kits, treatments, and equipment needed to combat the disease. Iran has taken giant strides in the health and medical sector over the past two decades. In fact, Iran's medical device market is growing faster than the world average. The country is globally ranked fourth for engineering over 1,000 medical devices to show for it too. Plus, this technological capacity has allowed the country to churn out advanced devices in the medical sector. Out of the 1,000 active medical device manufacturers, nearly 230 of them are knowledge-based firms. These companies generate some 30% of revenues in the domestic medical device market. That's all based on figures from the Vice Presidential Office for Science and Technology. Going off of data from Iran's Medical Equipment Office of the Ministry of Health, over 2,000 different types of medical devices are domestically produced. All of these meet EU standardization requirements for sales. Also, statistics showed over half of the 500,000 medical devices made globally have Iranian versions, reducing imports by 10%. Iran also exports these items to over 50 countries worldwide, including Russia, Germany, and Italy, among others. The National Medical Device Directorate reported that back in 2018, this market was worth nearly $3 billion. The latest figures have not been made public yet, and this amount is likely much higher this year. The surge in production in this sector is attributed to the hard work of knowledge-based firms and research institutions. Gas powers production, and oil greases the gears of the industry. Without gas and oil, most industries probably wouldn't thrive as they are today. The world consumes around 36 billion barrels of oil per year. Oil and gas are major industries in the energy market and play a significant role in the global economy as the world's primary fuel source.
Meanwhile, the process and systems involved in producing and distributing oil and gas are highly complex. They require lots of money and state-of-the-art technology.
Today, we'll venture through Iran's oil and gas industry. This sector is massive, and its enormity doesn't quite sink in until you visit one of the industry's annual exhibits. So, we visited the country's 26th International Oil, Gas, Refining and Petrochemical Exhibition, dubbed the Iran Oil and Gas Show. We'll explore this sector's development and uncover why it's essential to the national economy.
The Oil and Gas Show is one of the largest exhibitions in the global oil industry. It takes place every year and serves as a place for domestic and foreign industry participants to interact. The exhibition is based on the theme of knowledge-based oil, Iranian production, and global exports. It is based on this year's economic goal set by Iran's leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. The leader has emphasized strengthening the knowledge-based economy by adopting a scientific and technical approach in all fields. The exhibition showcases the latest products made by Iranian knowledge-based firms. It's a platform for expanding business markets and finding potential customers and suppliers, among other things. We caught up with a few participants to see what types of products and services they offered in this sector. This company manages an entire oil field in southern Iran. Moreover, it engineers machines and compressors needed for refining and processing crude oil and gas products.
Petro Iran Development Company, Petco, is one of the subsidiaries of NIOC, and we are acting as an ENP and GC contractor, and we are involved in several upstream and downstream projects, mainly in Iran and even abroad. The 26th Oil and Gas Show was one of the biggest show during the past even 10 years. As I noticed during these 3 days, there were very good participation of foreign companies. And these foreign companies, it was my surprise that they are not seeking for individual work by themselves. They are looking for cooperative work. Joint ventures with Iranian companies, and because we have a very good, capable Iranian manufacturers and contractors, and I have seen lots of agreements that have been signed during these 3 days. There are very big opportunities for investment in Iran because of nowadays situation in the world. There are a very massive request, demand for Iranian oil and Iranian industry. Manufacturers and contractors, and as it was noticed in this fair, more than 8 billion euros of investment agreement was signed, and I think that it we have this opportunity to up to 20 billion euros of investment to sign with the Iranian and even foreign countries.
Another pavilion displayed the cutting-edge technology used in downstream and upstream oil industries. This company is also developing various oil fields and supplying electrical power.
Each year, scores of people and industry participants visit and hold pavilions in this exhibit. Such events also provide unique access to leading decision-makers in the oil and gas industry. Additionally, it is a place for knowledge exchange and determining current needs and future development vectors. This year, the fair opened with 1,200 Iranian and 44 foreign exhibitors from 11 countries.
Another benefit of the fair is networking and creating new business opportunities throughout the energy sector with prospective business agreements. A significant number of business deals were closed during the 3-day oil and gas show. There is a lot of potential for investment in the oil and gas industry. This exhibit provides chances to link investors with potential joint ventures in this field. It's noteworthy that 23 universities and research centres and over 100 knowledge-based companies, startups and technology parks participated in this event. High-profile representatives of foreign companies from 22 countries were present at the show too. The most notable was the Secretary General of the Gas Exporting Countries Forum, Mohammad Hamal. Other important figures included the Minister of Oil, Javad Oji, Parliament Speaker Mohammad Bagher Ghalibaf, and the Head of Parliament's Energy Committee, Feridun Hassan Vand. The sprawling fairgrounds were packed with all sorts of equipment and machinery used in the oil and gas industry. These ranged from advanced technology for extraction, processing, storage, transport, safety systems, and control technology. We spoke with a representative of a company specializing in producing composite pipes, which are high in demand in this sector. Iran's oil and gas industry is thriving and has taken giant strides in production. It owes its many successes largely to knowledge-based companies and research institutions that have offered their services in developing this sector. Expanding the gas and oil industry has been at the top of the government's agenda for years. Over time, it has implemented several measures to this end. The government is focusing on knowledge-based firms and research companies as the bedrock of developing the oil and gas sector. The Oil Ministry has outlined several goals to tap into the high capacities of knowledge-based firms to boost production in the oil and gas sector. These goals are optimizing production, overhauling production facilities, and value chain developments. This goes hand in hand with the domestic development of innovative technologies. So, the government is supporting knowledge-based firms and startups and their efforts to manufacture commodities and equipment required in the oil and gas industry. Finding investors, whether domestic or international, is a top priority for the government. Iran is rich with oil and gas reserves and is the fourth largest oil producer among OPEC members. Plus, Iran possesses the third largest oil reserves in the world. So it's not surprising that the government would want to find ways to exploit its potential. The Oil Ministry has inked 50 agreements and memoranda of understanding worth nearly $17 billion in the first 9 months of last year alone. These deals were with petrochemical holdings, banks, and negotiating with reputable international companies. The agreements mainly focus on developing joint oil and gas fields, flare gas collections, and developing value chains. It plans on using knowledge-based companies and domestic manufacturing potentials to this end. The Minister of Oil, Javad Oji, says exhibits like the Oil and Gas Show reflect Iran's capability and authority despite sanctions. Oji also explains that Iran's gas and oil sector is steadily inching forward and is proving the failure of the US sanction policies. The official highlighted that the Oil and Gas Show displays the country's resiliency and its ability to diversify its economy through energy diplomacy. The minister expressed optimism for the future of this industry as there are grounds for returning to the energy trade. Oji says this can happen through gas swap deals, finding new markets for oil and its byproducts, and exporting technical engineering services. All things considered, there is a bright future for Iran's oil market and industry. Plus, it offers numerous lucrative investment opportunities in downstream and upstream sectors. Well, it is time for me to go off screen for several minutes because my good friend and colleague is out there on the field to give you a new adventure. Take it away.
Traditional medicine or modern medicine? This is among the most frequently asked questions. At the end of this episode, you'll definitely get to an answer to this question, as we're going to walk you through an Iranian pharmaceutical manufacturer dubbed Boali Daru, which produces a range of traditional medicine.
Wow!
While traditional medicine uses traditional therapeutic methods, Bouali Daru says it constantly conducts research and development to come up with new medications and boost the effectiveness of its medicines. Practitioners of traditional medication say one of the proven advantages of herbal medicine is their zero side effect aspect. Bouali Daru says their drugs are produced purely from herbs and will not lead to any serious side effects. The Iranian pharmaceutical firm says it's yet to reach its full capacity in the production of traditional medicine. It says it seeks to produce more drugs for more diseases, and at the same time, it aims to present its products in the global market. Bouali Daru takes his name from renowned 10th century Iranian physician Avicenna, who is hailed internationally as the pioneer of traditional medication. Bouali Daru says it works on an hourly basis to improve the quality of its products, with the ultimate goal of promoting the acceptance of traditional medicine among the public.
Many thanks for that wonderful report. Awesome as always. Now, we are nearly out of time, but before we go, let's have a look at some interesting developments in Iran's medical sector. Iran's medical device sector is growing by leaps and bounds, particularly in recent years. Now, Italian and Iranian companies are set to cooperate in this field. Plans have been drawn out for joint production between Iran and Italy, which include investments from Italian companies. In addition, it might be interesting to know that there are good opportunities for cooperation between the two nations in Italy by employing the services of Iranian knowledge-based firms. These plans were set in place on the sidelines of Iran's Health Expo, where Italy held one of the largest foreign pavilions. The 23rd International Exhibition of Medical, Dental, Laboratory and Pharmaceutical Equipment, dubbed the Iran Health, was held in May. Dimension technologies are grabbing the spotlight with numerous new applications. An Iranian group of researchers has built a three-dimensional scanner that can scan the entire body in a fraction of time. Exciting. The scanner collects information from the body using infrared radiation. It takes only a minute. The scanner captures the position of the body in reality and registers data translated to virtual reality through a light or laser beam. Its developers say the technology gives doctors an exact image of their patients, allowing them to study it without testing the patient directly. Earlier this year, Iran's Nanotechnology Innovation Council held an exhibit in the capital Tehran, displaying the country's latest developments in the nanotech sector. Nearly 50 new products and services in medicine, industry, construction, and the environment were presented at the four-day event. Over 800 nanoproducts are currently produced in the country by roughly 450 science-based and industrial companies. Well, that brings us to the end of the program for today. Thank you for tuning in this week. I am Samson Seas, captain of the Seven Seas. Sees you in the next bazaar.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us. The keys of life.
The world is a very, very big house. Many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up. We must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين.
My name is Sheikh Zayed Al-Salami.
A few years ago I started the course of wanting to commentate on a very important book that I believe is something that would be useful for everyone who reads it, and that is the book Mafatih Al-Hayat, written by Ayatollah Al-Uzma Al-Sheikh Jawadi Amuli. So far in everything that we have gone through in this simple book, very valuable book as well, is that we can live in anywhere, any part of the world, and uphold our religious values without compromising, and also be successful in coexisting with others and not forfeiting anything as far as our belief system is concerned. Without doubt, we do understand that animals themselves, who have been created by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, have a benefit, and they weren't created for out of vanity or for no reason. And this benefit goes back not only to nature itself, but also to us human beings. Of course, when you're trying to analyze, you know, why you have a rooster, why do you need to have a sheep, and all these things, there are many interpretations and explanations that we're able to give. You know, I think one of the most important things that we can look into is that balance of, for example, the deek, the rooster, you know, being accustomed to calling out, that would be a good thing, was because it's an early riser, and you become an early riser. You know, cats are usually dealing with insects and rodents and things like that, keeping the house clean and, you know, keeping everything intact as far as all of these things are concerned. But then we have the other side, and that is an animal that should not be kept, an animal that should not become a part of your family, and that is a dog. Now, of course, in today's society, when we talk about dog in a reprehensible way, in a negative way, people become very, very offended, especially dog lovers. They become very offended. And I think one of the interesting things that we are able to understand in Islamic heritage is that dogs have been used by Muslims for centuries and centuries. You know, al-kalb al-saluqi, you know, which we always read about and study about in ahkam, in fiqh, you know, talking about the hunting dog and the pure Arabian bred dogs that in today's world are not only very, very unique and beautiful, but also very expensive as well. So, you know, dog keeping is not something foreign to Islam, nor is it something that Islam completely objected and rejected. But in the culture, when it does come to who is man's best friend, in some cultures it's the dog, in some cultures it's the hawk, in some cultures it's the horse or the camel, and so on and so forth. So when a dog is spoken about in that sense, in being najis, in not being allowed to become a part of the family and things like that, it needs to be understood in the correct way. But here we are able to see from the ahadith from Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam, again, the main point of observing of three important fundamental concepts. Number one, as Sheikh Jawadi Amuli says, nadhafa, cleanliness. Number two, tahara, it being pure. And or you making sure that you are observant of issues of tahara and najasa. And number three, hygiene as well, which means that you shouldn't allow, for example, animals to lick the say or eat from the same utensils that you are going to be using for your consumption.
Ayatollah Javadi Amali, the author of the book Mafatih al Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatihul Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc. But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree. Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam, who has stressed out the reward for praying, has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment.
There are many lessons
of the book
by those prophets. And
eat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
Here one hadith as far as the animal that has been censured in Islam, which is, of course, in this case, a dog. Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, he says, "La tadkhulu al-malaika baytan fihi suratun." Angels will not come into a house which has a surah. Here, surah does not mean image. It does not mean a picture. Surah here means statues or idols. وَلَا كَلْبٌ, nor will angels enter into a house that has a dog. وَلَا جُنُوبٌ, nor will it enter into a house where there is a person in the state of janabah. تَنَزَّهُ عَنْ قُرْبِ الْكِلَابِ, as another hadith says. And we are able to understand that when it does come to this whole issue of animals, you're able to keep a dog if it's a shepherd dog, if it's a security dog, if it's a hunting dog, if it's, for example, a guiding dog. You know, in these cases, it's okay, it's permissible. Even though the animal, the dog, still stays najis, you still need to observe cleanliness, tahara, and hygiene. But it will be permissible from a shara'i perspective for you to be able to use. And in such a case, of course, you know, you're still going to be observant of all of the other ahkam and issues as well. And so there are certain animals that would be good for you to keep. There are certain animals that would be reprehensible for you to keep. And in the case of a dog and also a pig. Pig goes without saying, of course. You cannot have a dog purely for the sake of it being a pet. And if you do have a dog for those four reasons that we mentioned, then, of course, you still need to remember that you need to be observant of issues of tahara and najasa and cleanliness and hygiene. And, of course, you're still going in any circumstance to respect and honor the animal. And we're going to be mentioning a lot of things, even when it comes to a dog, how Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi used to deal with dogs as well. Inshallah, we will continue on speaking about benefiting from animals in the next segment. Walhamdulillahi rabbil alameen. Wa salatu wa salamu ala Sayyidina Muhammad wa alihi tahirin.
Driving past, walking fast to the field of dreams.
hear the children's cries.
There was The Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time, in time.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.